Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable for this 15th day of August. It is a Friday, and we are thrilled that you are with us. 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and very happy that you are here, very happy that you are ready to listen, very happy that you have turned on some sort of device that allows the words that are hurling their way through the atmosphere, through tubes or not tubes or satellite or however you get them, that you have decided to try to capture what it indeed we are throwing out into the atmosphere, and we appreciate that more than you will ever know. We hope we won't let you down. I told the panel earlier, just as the microphone was going on, I hope this goes well. I'm in a mood. So I...
We all got up to leave.
Yes, yeah. Well, and but I'm thrilled that you're all here. I'm thrilled that our panelists are here. We have a lot to talk about, and we'll get to that in just a second. Just listening to the music of Billy Idol. Billy will be at SPAC on Sunday night with the one and only Joan Jett, who we heard from yesterday in our bumper music. I have to say that I'm going to the show. I'm very excited. I listened and I read Billy Idol's autobiography from about 5 or 6 years ago. And the fact that that man could make music, given the amount of drugs that he was on, is just unbelievable. The fact that he's still alive is unbelievable. But good God. And but, you know, he survived the 80s and is here and 70 years old, I believe. So good for him. But we'll
70.
See.
70.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll be listening.
We can
to
keep going.
Well, Keith Richards has a few years on him, I think.
Again,
but he looks like it.
Well, there's actually
but
a funny...
Keith Richards has always looked like it, right?
Okay.
Like, when he was 23, he looked like he was 70.
But there's a great story in the book where this is maybe in the late 90s, and the Stones are in this recording studio, and Billy Idol and his people are in a studio. And Billy Idol is got like this, I don't know, this Peruvian brown heroin that he's just is just addicted to, and he's gone nuts, and he turns around and Keith Richards looks at him and says, "You know, maybe you should calm down." And I think if Keith Richards tells you to calm down, maybe you've got a real problem, right? Well, good morning, all. Welcome. We have a lot to talk about. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck is in the house. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
I'm well, and it's great to be with you all.
Yes, wonderful to have you here. Bill Hammond joins us, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Joe, I'm not in a mood.
Oh, good.
I'm completely mood-free.
Mood-free? We should get a mood ring and test that out.
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it? Yeah, we should do that for all of us.
We need to resurrect mood rings. They were so fun.
And lava lamps.
And a pet rock. Yeah. Let's sort of have all those things just
and
ready for
bottoms.
Us.
Too.
Huh?
And the Chia Pet.
The Chia Pet, yeah. Magic 8-Ball. All signs point to yes. We could just ask it. What's going to happen today? How's the meeting going to go between Putin and Trump?
Not well. We know that.
Well, I'm going to go online and ask the online Magic 8-Ball that very question.
There you go. Do that.
Signs point to yes.
The voice you hear right now is that of CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
I am really, really good. I actually last night went to the soft opening of the new hockey arena for Union College, which is over near Rivers Casino, where Mohawk Harbor is. And my son dropped me off there because I was meeting my husband there. And my son was like, "What is this? This is awesome." Because what they've done over there is incredible. And this is a really, really nice rink. I mean, my kudos to Gillespie for the development there, and it's beautiful and very thoughtfully done, but it's just amazing.
I have to say that my brother played hockey, and I spent a lot of time in a lot of different rings,
And I haven't been in this since it opened. I was there as it was getting ready to open, and but just incredible.
Yeah,
they've done a beautiful, beautiful job, and it's good to have them.
There's not a bad seat in the place.
No,
I mean you could see the ice anywhere.
Well, and good for Union College. It was a great team and very fun. So.
Yeah, the new Union College president was there, and she's great.
Wonderful. Well, welcome. We'll have to get her on and see if she wants to join our panel. Let's see. One more thing that I want to talk about, and that is that Hudson River Sampler is going to be on the road. We have two WAMC on the road events that I want to tell you about. One is Hudson River Sampler from Schenectady tomorrow, Saturday, August 16th at 7 p.m. We're recording performances of WAMC's 43-year-old folk music jamboree, the Hudson River Sampler, on the Music Haven stage in Central Park in Schenectady. Wanda Fisher, along with WAMC's Sarah LeDuc, will share memories and music from four decades of the Sampler, with special music guests Joe Jenks, Michael Gerling, Kate McDonnell, and Dan Berggren.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it sounds
great. I love Wanda Fisher.
Yeah, it'll be great.
I want to be Wanda when I grow up.
It'll be great. It'll be great with Sarah, who was there for all four decades.
She used to party. I think she used to party with Keith Richards and Billy Idol.
Billy Idol, yeah, that's absolutely
right. She drank
them
under the table.
It's a free event. You can learn more at WAMC.org or MusicHavenStage.org.
Can you just show up?
Yeah, I think you can, but you can learn more at our website or their website and find out. But it's right in Central Park in Schenectady,
nice.
Which is a beautiful park
as
well. Then on September 8th, you know, after Labor Day, when we button down and say, oh, it's fall and we have to start being professional again. On Monday, September 8th at 9 a.m., we will be broadcasting from the High Peaks Resort in Lake Placid, New York. This is part of our On the Road series. And we'll be our next stop on the great hit parade of places is Lake Placid. We'll be broadcasting from 9 to 12. Now, what's cool about this is we'll be broadcasting to you, our WAMC listeners, from 9 to 10, and just to you from 9 to 10. From 10 to 12, we will be doing a simulcast with North Country Public Radio. Mm. So if you are listening to us on North Country Public Radio, you will hear the show. If you are listening to us on WAMC, you will hear the show. NCPR's Emily Russell and Kara Chapman, along with myself, will dig into demographic and livelihood challenges facing the Adirondacks, from an aging population to a workforce struggling to find affordable housing, as well as welcoming questions from their live audience. We will also be talking about trade issues, Canada, and trade issues right on the border, you know, and they have a great input and relationship there that they are trying to, keep going. So we'll talk to them. It's an in-person event at the High Peaks Resort, 9 to 12, simulcast from 10 to 12. Tickets for the in-person event are available through WAMC and NCPR. There is a registration fee of $5, and all you got to do is go to WAMC.org. So we'll tell you more about that as time goes on, but just know that those two events are coming up. But the big one tomorrow night, WAMC on the road, Hudson River Sampler from the city of Schenectady. All right, let's get started with what is going on in the news, and quite a bit, as you may have noticed. And we begin with the big story of the day, and that, of course, is the meeting taking place between the President of the United States and the President of Russia, Donald Trump, and what's his name? Vladimir Putin. Thank you very much.
Putin.
And so we want to hear from you on this, and want to hear from our group on what is going on. This meeting, of course, takes place in Alaska and is something that has been, not in the works for a very long time, but has turned around very quickly. So there's an article in the New York Times this morning, how President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin could unfold. A sudden feud, an impasse, or a first step toward a ceasefire in Ukraine are all possible at the summit as the two leaders navigate thorny issues. This is issues such as Ukraine's territory and NATO expansion. These each of these could manifest in Anchorage when President Trump and Vladimir Putin meet at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, the first face-to-face discussion between American and Russian leaders since the invasion of Ukraine 3.5 years ago. And the scenarios that could unfurl are as unpredictable as the leaders themselves, both brimming with confidence that in a personal encounter they can manipulate events and each other. Sounds like a charming afternoon, doesn't it? So we'll find out more as the day progresses, but as we preview this conversation and talk about what is possible and what is important, we go to our panelists. Judith, would you like to start us off?
Well, wouldn't it be nice if they got a ceasefire? So I think we all have to root for that, but also be realistic about what's really unfolding here. You know, the funny thing about Trump is 1 week he is in a bromance with Putin. The next week he's telling him, if you don't knock it off with more bombing in Ukraine, you know, I'm really not going to be your friend. You know, 1 week he is so harsh towards Zelensky. We all remember the fated White House meeting that was so awful. You know, and then Zelensky gets on the phone with him and they're best buddies. And so, you know, Trump has been very inconsistent on Russia and Ukraine. I think Putin will probably gain more out of this than the United States for two reasons. One is it gives Putin some diplomatic legitimacy, which I don't think he deserves. He's been pretty isolated, particularly with European leaders. I think the big mistake is not having Zelensky at the table. Trump is saying, well, we're going to do a second meeting and maybe invite Zelensky and other EU leaders. I was struck by the fact that Putin is bringing a delegation of businesses with him. And there was some reporting that they may talk about extracting mineral rights in Alaska for Russia. So I think there is there's a pretty strong business element to this. I hope they're serious about working on a ceasefire. And remember, you know, Putin thought he would just roll over Ukraine. He thought this war would be over in a week or two. And Ukraine is hanging on. American attention has shifted more to Gaza because of the destruction and the starvation there. But I think this meeting reminds us that Putin wants to grab as much territory in Europe as he can. And so, you know, I hope they have a productive meeting, but my expectations are very low.
What we know about the meeting schedule, according to the White House, the summit is expected to begin in Alaska around 3 o'clock our time, and that Trump and Putin will say a few words before holding a one-on-one conversation with interpreters present. Negotiations will then continue over a working breakfast, which will include Russian and U.S. delegations, with 5 representatives each accompanied by experts. Also, aides are saying that the Russian members were, that they have a whole list of Russian aides and business leaders, as you mentioned, people who will be in that room. The team traveling with Trump include Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. That, according to the White House, and the White House Press Secretary confirmed the one-on-one talks would be followed by a bilateral lunch. Oh, those are good.
Well, I have the answer from the Magic 8-Ball, if anyone wants to know.
Yeah, what does it say?
So I first asked, will the Trump-Putin meeting in Alaska today result in a ceasefire? And it said, yes, why not? I'm like, this is
That's not an answer.
Right. And so then I changed it to the Putin-Trump meeting, and it said, yes, but it will take time. I think that might be
But those
accurate.
Are not magic eight ball answers.
No, I know. So it's not the original. No, the other ones were, you know, signs point to.
All signs point to yes.
Right, yeah.
Try again
definitely
later.
Maybe. Yeah, you know, something like right. that, right?
But,
so what do you think rather than the magic eight ball?
So here's what I think. I think it's very interesting. First off, I don't think it's a problem that he doesn't have Zelensky there, because I think that is a putting them in the same room without having some preset notion as to where it might go is probably not positive. It's probably not going to be helpful. These guys hate each other. And I think that probably it's not a bad idea. I do think that part of this, the timing may be a distraction from the whole Epstein thing. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, you know, given who's going to be there, it does look like Trump's approach is to look for a financial incentive to get Putin to figure out a way to claim victory and not be a further threat. I don't trust Putin for 10 seconds, but it's an interesting approach, right? And that's why he's got these business people there, and possibly that's why it's in Alaska. It's also, you know, not a long flight for Putin, although he goes back in time, actually. So there's that.
Oh, if we all could go back in time.
But
we're going to take a quick break.
Yeah, okay.
And then when we come back, we'll finish up with your thoughts. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion talking about the meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in Alaska that will be taking place about 3 o'clock our time, beginning at that time, and getting the mood of the room here from the panel. And we had to go to a break, so I had to cut off Heather, but please go on.
Yeah, I think the last thing I really wanted to say is I think the administration has very intentionally been setting the expectations low on this. I don't think they believe they're going to get a ceasefire out of this meeting. But if they can get the beginnings of some kind of maybe trade discussion that would be linked to Russia, you know, having the ability to A, declare a victory, and B, stop. That's what it looks to me like their end game is. And also, I would say, you know, the reverse of that is if it goes nowhere, this gives the administration the cover to basically impose additional sanctions. They could do that now, but it looks like an escalation. It looks like a provocation, and it certainly would be portrayed that way by Putin if they didn't have maybe the kabuki theater of having a real discussion and having it fall apart. So, you know, for all of that, he doesn't need Zelensky there, and having Zelensky there would probably be a distraction because the goal is not to have Zelensky and Putin reach an agreement with each other. Which will happen like on Never Day. So,
you know, I don't disagree with you on that, although I do. It does seem counterintuitive when you're talking about two leaders talking about a country that isn't yours that you think, what are we talking about? We're talking about Russia. We're talking about Ukraine. And you would think that the head of Ukraine would be in the room.
Yeah, so yeah, Putin has tried to frame this whole conflict as Russia, not Russia against Ukraine, but Russia against the U.S. and Russia against the West generally, and this totally feeds into that.
Yeah.
But you know, the stakes are so incredibly high. You right now, Russia, like the tide has once again shifted. Russia's solidly in occupying a bunch of what used to be Ukrainian territory. You'd hate, like, as Judith said, you'd like to think there's a ceasefire coming, but I'm not sure a ceasefire that just freezes in place the status quo is going to satisfy Ukraine.
And a ceasefire negotiated with Zelensky at the table is a loss for Putin. And I think that it's a capitulation, right? So I think because then Zelensky gets credit for it, and he can't have Zelensky get credit for it. He needs for it to be a victory that he got for the Russian people. By he, I mean Putin. So I'm not surprised. And now I am far from a, you know, diplomatic expert, but you don't putting someone at the table who has no ability to move the ball forward because he can't give up more. And that's what Putin wants, right? It's not useful.
Yeah. Putin just wants, I think he wants a couple things, but most notably, as you say, Heather, he wants more territory. I actually think Putin will play Trump because he knows the way you play Trump is you flatter him. Not hard to do if you can just kind of suck it up and do it. Putin's economy is collapsed. You know, yeah. He's in terrible shape. When Joe read the names of the U.S. delegation, the Treasury Secretary, the Commerce Secretary, I think that points to they're really looking at business deals,
yes,
and lesser tariffs. And I would argue... Why do we want a business relationship with Putin, who kills his political adversaries, who is so far from a democracy? Why do we want that relationship?
It's sort of a question of how much we're willing to concede to him and how much we're willing to let him save face in order to stop the bloodshed. Yeah. And like that is, I mean, it's a pretty cynical calculation, but that's what diplomacy ends up being.
Your way out of it.
I mean, there's not a whole lot of paths here, right? One is escalate and get directly involved. Another, and he's not going to do a ceasefire if we threaten that, right? So the other is, you know, have Ukraine cede more land, which is not acceptable because that's just going to encourage Putin to continue on and start looking at Poland and Finland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and certainly I think the folks over there are very worried about that possibility. And then the last is figure out some other avenue, some door that Putin can gracefully exit through with the belief that he would stay out that door. And, you know, I don't think he's going to stay out that door. But he's human and he's not going to be around forever either. And the Russian people at some point have to realize that this was not something that was beneficial to them in any way.
Yeah. Just a few hours ago, Trump did a gaggle on Air Force One and about the trip on his way to Alaska. And a reporter asked him, would you ever consider putting American security forces on the ground in Ukraine? Mm-hmm. And he said, maybe, but not through NATO. And then he dissed NATO. And he said, maybe with European partners. So, yikes.
That would be such a turnaround for Trump. Like, Trump has wanted to avoid foreign entanglements. At least rhetorically.
Yeah, but that...
And in fact, he has avoided...
That's got to be directed at Putin, right? Like, this is one of the... I just ran through those possibilities. That's one of them. And Putin, if his... You know, we don't really know if he's feeling like his back is against the wall. But if he is, you know, giving him some kind of trade agreement, lifting of sanctions or whatever, with no new land. I mean, that... I think that seems to be... what I think the agenda is. And if it's not, probably should be, right? Like, because there's no other options here.
Mm-hmm. So, it's kind of a negotiating tactic is to appear crazy. And we have two people who are crazy in their own ways, right? Trump is mercurial and willing to blow things up, turn on a dime. And Putin is crazy in the more kind of, you know, violent and bloodthirsty way. It's really like the possibilities here are kind of horrible to think about.
Well,
but I'm also struck by the historical echoes. Like, you know, the U.S. bought Alaska from Russia in 1867.
Maybe it's gonna
and part of the
back.
Reason the Tsar at the time wanted to sell was that he needed money after a war in Crimea. So, which is, you know, Putin recently annexed away from...
So what else does Alaska have that we could buy?
Oh, they want the minerals.
Well, right, but I mean, Trump loves the idea of adding new territory to the U.S. Like, is there something that, I mean, maybe that's an interesting thought. Like, can't buy Greenland from them, right, or Iceland from them, but is
there was
there
some
Canada?
Island. Wasn't there some island that recently changed hands or something?
I don't know. Maybe there's something up there that he wants to buy.
Well, this is a moment where it's really too bad the U.S. State Department has been hollowed out because, you know, the way these things work is a lot of advanced meetings with skilled diplomats who know how to do this. But Trump has created this climate where he and only he can cut the deal. And I'm pretty pessimistic that, you know, it's going to work. I don't think there was any advanced bilateral discussions.
Bill, a moment ago, was talking about the difference between the two men and how they'll look at this. This is how Roman put it, which is, so the devil and the Antichrist are meeting to decide how to carve up Ukraine. Great. And that kind of...
feels like a South Park episode.
Puts it in a nutshell.
Talk about bad vibes in that room. Ooh, Trump and Putin together. Ooh.
Adam says, I have zero confidence that anything productive will get done. Janice says, I find it such a sad reflection of our current state of affairs that such an important meeting is happening between two amoral men who don't care anything about anyone but themselves. Scary as heck, says Jan.
So I'm not going to remember all the history on this, but Ronald Reagan made a big deal about creating a missile defense shield, which all the technocrats thought was a disastrously bad idea that would lead to escalation and et cetera. But he wanted to do it, and he convinced the Russians at the time that he was going to do it, that he was crazy enough that he was going to do that. And for that reason, they started making a bunch of concessions at the bargaining table on nuclear weapons. So I remember at the time being horrified at what Reagan was doing. And yet it turned out to pay off in the end. So, we can cross our fingers.
The thing is, Reagan, who I didn't agree with, actually had adults in the room and skilled negotiators.
But you probably wouldn't have said that at the time.
Probably not.
No, that's a good point. Yeah.
But okay, it's all in context.
It's all in context, yes.
Yeah. Context and comparison.
Oh, my
yes.
God. Missing the day, the Reagan administration.
Scott says, how can it be that with bodies piling up, they're going to talk about mineral rights? That level of crassness is so Trump. Given the international dateline, maybe one of them will miss the meeting. Oh, I thought it was tomorrow, they would say.
I think crassness, like diplomacy involves crassness. I don't think you can get away from that.
Yeah, I mean, especially with these personalities, I think, you know, with Putin on the other side, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, promoted pictures of himself shirtless riding a horse around. He's image like times 10, right? He's all about the strongman image. He's not going to settle for a meeting with negotiators. He needs to meet with Trump, right? That's for this to be resolved. And it's people pounding their fists on the table. I do think I actually personally think that the choice of meeting in Alaska was a good one. And I know that there's this, you know, horrified gasp that we're allowing him on American soil and that it somehow is elevating him. I think it's actually the right place to meet with him because it's where our countries actually touch or they're closest.
Intersect, yeah.
And there is, as was mentioned, there is a history there. So if the goal is to do some kind of a commerce-style deal that gets them to stop killing people in Ukraine. I mean, there's the subtext of, and we've done this before.
Ray says, Trump is clearly outclassed by Putin in every way, and Trump knows it. Putin is simply more intelligent and cunning than Trump. Trump talks a bully's game, but he'll taco. Trump always chickens out. When they get face to face, that from Ray. And one more letter before we take a break. We go to Barbara, who says, since Putin is under indictment by The Hague, hopefully he will be arrested in Alaska since part of the U.S. I believe it is possible, isn't it? It may be logistically possible. I don't think it is possible.
No. One of the reasons they wanted to do it on U.S. soil was because it was we're not part of the treaty where we would arrest him. So,
considering the tremendous success President Trump has had bringing people together to end war, shouldn't we be optimistic? That from Peter. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll move on to other subjects. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. One breath away, my dear. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 15th of August. Very nice to have you here listening to us, and we welcome you. We hope you have a beautiful weekend and get ready for a beautiful weekend. Let me move the topic of conversation from Alaska to the District of Columbia and talk about a topic that I think we've talked about all week this week, which is what is happening in the District of Columbia. And beginning with the president's comments on Monday of bringing in the National Guard and having the government take over the police department. And so now that has all been extended a bit. President Donald Trump on Thursday promised to have the crime situation solved in D.C. very soon, as Attorney General Pam Bondi issued an order seeking to strip senior city police officials of their remaining power. Bondi directed D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and the police department to submit to a new governing structure with Terry Cole, a Trump appointee, as emergency police commissioner. Bondi said Cole, who serves as the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, shall, quote, assume all the powers and duties vested in the District of Columbia Chief of Police. Earlier in the day, White House and Pentagon officials provided some new details about the increased presence of federal law enforcement and National Guard troops in the Capitol after Trump declared an emergency in D.C. this week and put the city's police department under federal control. A White House official said federal operations will run 24 hours a day rather than focus on just the nighttime hours, and will target high-crime areas known as hotspots. This all going on, there were also signs of stepped-up efforts to address the tents and other visible signs of homelessness that have long seized Trump's attention. Meanwhile, we just learned this moments ago that the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's attempt to take over the city's police department. The lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court comes after the Trump administration moved on Thursday to expand its control, as I just described, and installing this emergency commissioner and revoking policies that limit officers' cooperation with immigration enforcement. Federal officials began sweeping homeless encampments in Washington on Thursday night after city officials and advocates urged homeless people to leave or risk arrest. I've said this over the last three or four days, so I apologize for repeating myself, but I find the most disturbing part of this is this conflation between crime in the city of Washington, D.C., and the homeless population. Two very separate issues that seem to be conflated in this particular case. Bill.
Yeah, it's a disturbing and even frightening display of kind of unilateral sort of, I mean, the word authoritarian does come to mind when someone starts sending troops and, you know, people with guns and stuff into a city. he seems to have some legal authority to be doing this. So I wonder if this, you know, they are the District of Columbia is kind of a ward of the federal government, and he is the president, for better or for worse. So I don't know that a lawsuit's going to is going to be successful. The ultimate answer is for some other part of the federal government, Congress comes to mind, to step up and to tell him to cool his jets. I do think, like, the sad part of this is that crime in this country is a serious issue, and I don't think it's productive for Democrats to say this is ridiculous, crime isn't a big deal, because crime is a big deal, and particularly in Washington, D.C., which is kind of shocking given that it's our nation's capital. It should be a showcase of law and order. From what I've read, the crime rate there is about six times worse than it is, or the murder rate is six times worse than it is in New York City. And New York City, by international by national standards, is safe, but not by international standards. Like the people in London would not tolerate what's going on in New York City. So that's part of what's sad here, is that we should be having some kind of conversation about crime, and we should be taking action on it. It just shouldn't look anything like what's going on in Washington right now.
Go ahead.
I think the lawsuit is not going to relate to his authority to bring the National Guard in. I think it's pretty clear, and I think that's why no one sued up until this point. Because under federal law, the president specifically has the authority to deploy the National Guard in Washington, D.C., and it's ordinarily governors that have that power in their own states, but it not being a state, that's what the law says. But I think the difference is what's probably suing on is the question of whether or not he can assume the role of law enforcement. Right now, the National Guard is unarmed. They're not conducting arrests. They're actually doing cleanup, and they're calling it beautification. But that's the language that they're using to describe sweeping people out of the homeless encampments. The emergency that granted him the authority to deploy them is crime. So it's a question as to whether or not, if that is an emergency that justifies deploying or engaging the National Guard, do they then have the authority to take over for law enforcement? And I don't know if that's settled law or not. I that's not something I've been able to find. But there are certainly lots of examples in the past where the National Guard has done that in states. So
so much of what Trump does, he's going where no
right
president has ever gone before, and so there's not going to necessarily be relevant law.
Yeah, lots of governors have used the National Guard to conduct law enforcement activities in riots and actually do arrests and
Governor Hochul put the National Guard in the New York City subway system.
Yeah,
which I thought was.
But
kind
I don't
of
know if
nutty.
they're armed and if
oh they are
they are
yeah,
okay because these
they're...
guys are not armed in D.C. They have they are wearing soft hats, not helmets. They are not arresting people.
But they are patrolling with DEA and DC police, and they did like a car pullover, what do you call those stops, two nights ago. And they were looking for people who were not wearing seatbelts and who had their rear lights were not working. And they actually arrested two people. And it gives you the impression that Trump is trying to create a police state in the nation's capital. Washington, D.C. definitely needs help on legitimate ways to protect public safety and reduce crime. Washington, D.C. definitely needs help with providing houses for homeless people. You know, if you want to solve homelessness, provide housing. But Trump is not looking to solve these two problems. He's just trying to flex his muscles, create an atmosphere of fear. And if it's really crime that is driving this, the top cities with the highest crime rates per capita are Memphis, Tennessee, Oakland, St. Louis, Baltimore,
Oakland, California,
St. Louis, Baltimore, Detroit, Little Alexandria, Louisiana, Cleveland and New Orleans. Trump does not talk about those communities. He's targeted LA. He's targeted DC. It's not a coincidence that the mayors in both of those cities are African-American women who are Democrats. And most people who are responsible public servants try to de-escalate situations. He's trying to escalate by ordering that the DEA chief is now the emergency police commissioner. DC is unique because it's not a state. And I think this is actually going to provide some momentum for DC statehood. People are going to look back at this. But this is abhorrent. And Trump has said he wants to do this in other cities. He's named New York City. He's named Chicago. And this is fascism. And it's trying to get people used to a climate where you have armed police in the streets. The most striking thing was two nights ago, you had they always walk around in like big mobs of police. It's like 7 or 8 of these officers wearing masks patrolling Georgetown. Are you kidding me? Georgetown? I mean, if you really want to help with public safety, you go to high crime areas and not the mall. They were strolling around the National Mall.
Right. So in D.C., because it's this weird non-state entity,
right?
The chief criminal prosecutor is the U.S. attorney.
Jeanine Pirro, right?
Oh, is
yes,
that's
isn't
right.
she? Yeah.
That's right. Former Westchester County DA.
Former Fox News anchor and a known day drinker, if you saw her recent video on the situation with the sub. Watch that video.
In New York, it would be a locally elected district attorney who's in charge of prosecuting local crime. In Washington, it's the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney has been sort of scaling back the number of cases that they take and the number of people they prosecute. If you're I'm taking this from a columnist named Josh Barrow, but he's like, if you wanted to do something about crime in D.C., you would beef up that office. You would give it more resources. You would instruct Jeanine Pirro to bring more cases. And you would put more people in prison for the crimes that they're committing. That's like... It is kind of tending toward fascism and in the theater of it, of having, but the thing is, we have armed people in the streets of New York City is completely common, right? Like if you go to a train station or a subway station, you're liable to see somebody with a military style weapon.
And it's still unnerving, isn't it, when you see that?
But that's not happening. That's not fascism. That's just, security theater. Which, in some cases, can be helped.
You raise such a good point, Bill, and I think...
Wait to take a break. Sorry. Go ahead.
I think the reason why the U.S. attorney has reduced the attorneys prosecuting crimes is because crime actually is substantially reduced in Washington, D.C. It hasn't eliminated. There are huge perception problems, but the numbers are way down. So they probably just had to reassess their headcount.
We'll take a break. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. In the meantime, news with David Gustino. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our program this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning, 10 minutes past 10 o'clock. Let me remind you who is on the panel this morning. We have a great group, and I am thrilled they are all here. We welcome EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Thank you all. Let's go on. I would like to continue our conversation about Washington, D.C. And what is happening in the District of Columbia. We do have letters on this as well. Did anybody not? Was there any point that somebody wanted to make before we go to letters?
No, just that I'm disgusted by it. And it is, I think it's a preview of what Trump is going to try in other cities. I think that's what he's kind of laying the foundation.
Well, and he's been saying that, though. I mean, right? The five mm-hmm. cities. Yep. Five cities.
New York, that he said Chicago.
To look at other cities. And again, what I don't understand, it seems to me that if we get into a semantic discussion, I believe on yesterday's program, between the issue of of patrolling,
martial law.
Well, the idea that if you are, I think it was the terms that were used in the article that I was reading were roaming, and patrolling, and the idea here is that if you're roaming, it's that you don't have a particular purpose. Well, if the crime is down, and there isn't, and mm-hmm. you don't, and you're not in an area where the hot spots are. Then you are roaming, right? I mean, it's you're sort of just there, as opposed to where you're patrolling. If there is the actual activity that is going on, the thing I wonder is if you have your numbers that are down, and you are not using those numbers now, but then you decide that you are going to adopt those numbers, do you then declare victory? See, look what we did.
Oh, that's probably the game plan. I mean, I'm not an expert on policing, but if you have people in uniforms with badges and et cetera, and you post them in a particular area, crime in that area is going to go down. It's going to come to a complete stop because nobody's going to commit a crime right in front of a cop. At least that. But the thing is, we can't afford to post people like that everywhere where there might be a crime. So what we do, the typical approach is to have, in the old days they used to have beat cops and they'd walk around, but mostly they drive to the scene of something that's been reported. So they're reactive instead of preventive. That's kind of the weird mix we have of policing. If you flood a neighborhood. It sounds like Georgetown's probably not the right neighborhood, but if you found the worst crime neighborhood and you flooded it with armed people, it doesn't matter whether they're DEA or National Guard or police, if you flood it with armed people, crime in that area is going to go down, and the local people might be grateful for that. The thing is, it's going to be very temporary. As soon as the armed presence walks away,
I go back to the National Guard is not armed. They're not patrolling.
But even just
uniform. Right.
People.
The uniform makes an impression. Yeah. I lived in Center Square for a long time, and there used to be mounted police officers, and it was really awesome when you could hear the horses. I like horses, so I have a bias, but you could hear them walking down the street, and it was you felt safer. Maybe you were or you weren't, but you could hear them, and they were big and very visible. And I think there's a lot less visibility to law enforcement now than there used to be. And, you know, the kind of flip side of that is that people are willing to, you know, aggressively go after people in uniform in some instances, and ICE in particular. I mean, that creates a different kind of an issue because if it becomes okay.
I want to take. When I see the National Guard, if you see them in New York, if you see them in the city, if you see them even around here, I found them to be armed.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying the article said that they are not armed in D.C.
In this particular case.
But okay. FBI, ICE, and DEA are, and they seem to be going around in little packs. And I think this is, you know, they're going to have inevitably a problem because FBI agents are not used to patrolling and certainly not in high crime areas. And then the question is, what about their day jobs? Doesn't the FBI have important work to do? dealing with drug cartels and violence and human trafficking and dealing with the Jeffrey political Epsteins corruption. Of the world yeah. and political corruption. And DEA is kind of important on drug issues. And ICE, I have very little regard for, so I think it's fine for ICE to be distracted so they're not kidnapping people off the streets of the United States. But this is not sustainable. It's not going to last a long time. This is performative. And I think a lot of this is an illustration that, and I know this is going to sound a little weird, but I don't think the Trump administration is good at governing. They're good at the show. They're good at trying to appeal yeah. to Fox News and Newsmax viewers. But if you want to solve homelessness, if you want to solve public safety, high crime issues, you actually need to know how to govern. And you look at like all the top appointees in the administration, you know, Pete Hegseth, Exhibit A, does he really know? He was a weekend Fox host. Weekend. And he's running the U.S. military.
Now, again, no, yeah. I don't want to diss our weekend broadcasters by any stretch. We have great respect for our, here at WAMC, we have great respect for our weekend
yes,
broadcasters.
Yes, at WAMC, but yes. not at Fox. I mean, you look at the top appointees, and they're not experienced at solving problems.
I don't want to expand this conversation, but I'm sorry. I find little difference between a Pete Hegseth on the weekend and Steve Doocy during the week. But okay.
Well, for some reason, Fox thought Hegseth was only good for the weekend.
He's more of an agriculture secretary.
Linda McMahon heading up education. Are you kidding me? Lee Zeldin at the EPA, who has reduced, you know, the role of the agency. Who doesn't want to have PFAS chemicals in their drinking water? My point is, these folks don't know how to govern.
What they are most good at and what they are seem to be most focused on is grabbing attention. Like we have this attention economy, right? And there's only so many things we can pay attention to. We have no choice but to pay attention to, you know, the president sending a bunch of militarized people into Washington, the nation's capital. And so to some extent, this discussion itself is playing into that, like we're feeding the beast. And I agree. It really has nothing. Like I had the same feeling about the healthcare legislation that just passed. I'm somebody who thought healthcare spending needed to be brought under control. But and, you know, sort of at the nominal level, that's what they're doing. But they did it in all the wrong ways because they weren't really focused on policy. And that was in Congress. That wasn't even really the Trump administration. So the Trump administration is all about news cycles and attention and feeding, like keeping people entertained isn't the right word, but keeping them
looking at the things they want them to look at.
Yeah.
A week ago or 10 days ago, we were talking about Epstein, right?
Don't be paying attention to the unemployment numbers. Mm-hmm. Don't be paying attention to the inflation number. Pay attention to, and you can't look away because it is important.
If you do it very intentionally. I actually was at a gathering yesterday and talking to someone who is a regular listener here. And he said that he said, are you still, you know, do you still go on once in a while? And I said, yeah. And he said, I should know that, but I stopped listening and following all news a year ago. He said, I got to the point where I just couldn't. I just couldn't do it anymore. And he said, you know, if something really big happens, people know they have to tell me. But what they think is really big in this context is usually not really big.
That's what Trump wants. And it's under, like, on a human level, I've often said, I don't know how Joe Donahue does this show every day talking about the Trump policies. But my news consumption is moderately reduced.
I was wondering how I do it, and then I sat down with Janine Pirro, and she said day drinking.
Yeah,
yeah. That's, yeah.
You gotta see this video from yesterday.
I don't know what's in the video, but I feel bad about actually saying someone does something like that without some kind of.
intervention.
Yeah, well, no confirmation. I mean, oh, okay. It seems like a very damaging.
Watch the video.
Okay. But all right. Point taken. Yeah. I had an English teacher in ninth grade. She would come in every day with like three bottles of Scope. And she would down those suckers every single day. There was no way she was going to get through a day. And no, she had no plaque until the state gave her a plaque for being Teacher of the Year. And I thought, well, no, because she's stoned out of her gourd. Anyway, go ahead, Judith. She's passed away. I feel safe in saying that story now. Go ahead.
What were we talking about?
We were talking about just this idea of, I don't know.
Looking away from the news.
You can't look away.
Psychologically, I would recommend everybody turn off their TVs. Because I went through a lot of my career as a journalist, and I would get all of my information from print, to some extent radio, and the internet, you know, like what became Twitter and just like the circulation of news that way. And people would come to me and they say, the media does this and the media does that. And I'd say, what are you talking about? They would always mean TV. The 24-hour cable.
That's really good advice.
It's a whole different environment. The thing is, a lot of people, that's where they get their news. And so I find myself kind of on a different wavelength a lot of times for that reason. But that would be my advice. If you're finding that the news is driving you crazy, get it from the newspaper instead of from the
television. This is all OJ's fault.
Yeah.
I mean, CNN, nobody watched CNN until the White Bronco, right? I mean, that's when everyone's like, oh, I need to be.
It was a visual story.
Yeah.
Most people get their news from social media, and that is really that is really worrisome because that's often not journalism. It's not like you're reposting a story from a legitimate news source.
You have to be a careful consumer.
Yeah, but you really, I mean, I am quite worried. Your colleague who said they just don't watch the news. I mean, we have to be informed because we have to stand up and take action when important issues.
Health,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And not everyone has to pay attention, but certainly, you know, we're only 7-8 months into this reign of terror. You have to pay attention or the country's not going to survive the next 3+ years.
We have a bunch of letters. Peter writes, Aaron writes, do you know what is the best way to reduce crime? A good economy, good paying jobs, affordable health care, and affordable housing. If these things were available to everyone, I guarantee the crime rate would drop. Then we go to Anthony, a would-be dictator is forming a personal police force authorized by a fake, never-ending emergency, criminalizing poverty and going after people for who they are rather than what they've done. Trump is continuing to attempt to remake America in the image of 1930s fascism. The last line of defense is the judiciary. Will they do their job? Help us, John Roberts. You're our only hope.
Uh-oh.
Then we go to Nancy. This is not about crime. This is clearly an introduction to the martial law of our future. The fascist regime is gearing up to quash protests and insurrections. They are clearly planning on more and more revoking our rights and preparing to install the military in our cities. Peter says, the reason for your ad hominem attacks, border closed, trillions in foreign investments, wars ended, Iran neutralized, low inflation, major trade deals. That from
Peter. So wait a minute.
Peter.
That one came out of left field. I'm glad we have listeners who aren't all on one side.
Yes.
But the last couple of things, no inflation.
War ended?
I mean, you could debate that, but not all of that was true. I would just want to say.
Jan says every time you use the name Trump, I implore you to also insert Project 2025. We probably won't do that. Trump is merely the tool of Project 2025, and all that is happening is part of Project 2025. Trump is only able to focus on his feuds with entertainers and to bask in the false praise from those who want to use him as a puppet. So that is from Jan. We then go to Theodore. How much money is being spent on deploying all these military to put down U.S. citizens? Gideon says Trump would love nothing better than the chance to declare martial law across the United States of America. This would allow him to shut down the press that he doesn't like and to arrest dissenters, journalists, and other opponents of this administration. The National Guard mobilization is a test of limits toward enacting the Insurrection Act, with the next step being martial law. Beware, this could all happen in the next 365 days. Finally, we go to Arabella. But the crime rate is coming down. How is that an emergency? We always welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so we only have a few moments before we take a break. Oh, this was another letter. The president has authority in D.C. Let's hope that after his success reducing crime and helping the homeless, that other cities will be inspired to do likewise. The government's first responsibility is the physical safety of its citizens. But is that what's going on here?
Not at all. No. And, you know, when he rounds up homeless people, where are they going? A military base somewhere? Are they going to disappear? Like people
Alligator
who are
Alcatraz.
Yeah, people who show up for legally required court hearings at 26 Federal Plaza and get grabbed by the DEA. Where are these folks going?
And we don't know the answers to that yet.
No.
I have a bit of a digression on emergencies.
Yes.
Because this has been a pet peeve of mine long before Trump came along. Governors declare emergencies, and usually there's not really – sometimes there'll be like a flood or a fire.
Hurricane.
An actual emergency. But other times they'll say, I'm declaring that gun crime is an emergency. And people will say, oh, yeah, gun crime's bad. So, you know, but really what that means is that the governor doesn't have to follow the normal oversight of contracting, so they can give contracts to their political donors. That's literally what happens in some cases. So the concept of falsely declaring using emergency or falsely declaring an emergency as a pretext to empower an executive, that goes on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Trump didn't invent that. He's taking something that was abused by previous executives and taking it to a new level.
And governors do that too.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
Yeah.
First of all, you have to name a czar, right?
Right. You need a something czar.
Yeah, the czar of whatever that problem is.
It's never a czarina.
Czarina just doesn't have the same. I mean, I think queen actually might be the.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back and continue our conversation for our last half hour together. Panel at WAMC.org.
Out of home, one more bad break.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, listening to the music of Billy Idol, who will be at SPAC on Sunday. And you can see the complete playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Talks between nations to hammer out a plastics treaty to end plastic pollution went on behind closed doors in Geneva, the final day of negotiations, as civil society groups urge countries to hold the line to secure a strong agreement. With time running out to seal a deal between 184 countries, environmental groups express concern that frontline communities, indigenous people, and others suffering the worst impacts of the world's growing plastic crisis were being sold out in an effort to secure a treaty without meaningful or legally binding measures that would address the scale of the problem at any cost. We learned this morning that they left without any deal. Judith.
Yeah. What a missed opportunity. Just 3-4 years ago, there was an effort to get the United Nations to pull together the whole world to figure out a strategy to reduce plastic pollution. And out of the gate, it was really a challenge. And we see what happens in Congress. We see what happens in the state legislatures around the country, where the sheer political power of the plastic producers overcome any process. And that happened in this UN negotiation. Center for International Environmental Law documented hundreds of plastic industry lobbyists participating in this treaty negotiation. And then, not surprising, we don't get anything in the end. There were meetings all over the world. People worked really hard on this. I didn't work on it because I didn't think it was actually going to work. And the United States aligned itself with Saudi Arabia and other fossil fuel petro nations. The real sadness is that the plastic pollution problem is getting worse every day. New studies documenting the presence of microplastics in various parts of our bodies, in our blood, in our kidneys, in our lungs. Most recently, a peer-reviewed study showing microplastics in our brains. It crossed the plastic crosses the blood-brain barrier. So this is a very serious health issue, not just for people living next to plastic production facilities in Louisiana and Texas and Appalachia, but it's a serious issue for all of us. And I think this is just a real missed opportunity. And now attention has to turn to state legislatures because Congress is not going to do anything. So the problem with plastic is it's just getting worse. That, by the way, is the title of my new book, The Problem with Plastic, which comes out by the New Press in December. I urge everyone to order my book, The Problem with Plastic, wherever you pre-order books. Bookstore.com, is that the name of the
Bookshop.org, I believe.
Sorry, bookshop.org, yeah. Or the New Press. And the book goes into the climate change implications of plastic, how we're turning our ocean into a landfill with plastic, personal health implications, and the data is there, but the political power of the plastic fossil fuel and chemical industry is just blocking progress, even at the international level.
I have to say, I'm completely unsurprised that it would be difficult to change, you know, to reach a deal that would significantly move away from the use of plastics, because they are so ubiquitous, but they're also extremely useful and even beneficial in many situations. So,
not if it's in your brain.
Well, so they might be in your brain, but they also might be protecting your brain in the form of a helmet, or they might be protecting your brain in the form of an airbag in your car, or the seatbelt, or the surgical devices that are being used to cure your brain cancer. So imagining a world without plastic is just extremely difficult. Plastic actually has, in some cases, has environmental benefits. If it's lightweight, that means you're not spending as much on fuel transporting things. I'm like anyone else. I don't want to think about having microplastics in my brain. But I also find it very difficult to imagine a world in which we just look around any room you're sitting in and try to imagine a world where none of the devices that have plastic in them can have plastic anymore. So there has to be some level of plastic. I don't think it's, you know, I'm sure the fossil fuel industry did get involved because it's a existential issue for them. I guess I feel like I wasn't following this debate, so I don't know what was on the table. But if it included production controls, for example, and I believe it did, I don't know how you tell the world you just can't have as many catheters as you have now.
But that's not what this is. The treaty and state legislation is not about eliminating plastic. You're right. There are some needed uses of plastic. A plastic car bumper makes the car more fuel efficient. There's plastic in wood turbines. What we're talking about is the massive amount of plastic pollution that is all over our environment, all over rivers and streams in the ocean, and now in our bodies. It is the treaty was looking for binding agreements to reduce, not eliminate plastic, and then equally important to reduce some of the 17,000 toxic chemicals used to make plastic.
But is the plastic in the bumper, doesn't that eventually end up in your bloodstream?
When
the car goes to the crusher and it gets crushed, happens?
The plastic that's winding up, we get plastic in our body from what we breathe and what we swallow. So it's mostly plastic packaging that is the concern. And that's what you see littered on Central Avenue, along rivers and streams, and why we are seeing such a high amount of microplastics in our bodies.
So shouldn't it be we were having a treaty on packaging?
Well, I think the realistic thing was that's what you were going to look to get your most reduction at.
So,
but go ahead.
Can I just want to say, because I generally agree with Bill, but I don't think anyone would be surprised by that. But I just wanted to point out that more than 10 years ago, actually close to 20 years ago, a very, very wise man named George Carlin predicted that the Earth is going to shake us off, that being us being humans, like a bad case of fleas, and then it will be the Earth plus plastic. That was one of his comedy routines. And every time we talk about plastic, all I can think of is the Earth plus plastic.
Well, and there's also the famous scene in The Graduate where he's like, I have one word for you, Benjamin, plastics.
Imagine if he said, I have one word for you, too, reusables and refillables. That's where you invest.
You know, you have spelling issues. It's too hard.
I want to move on to another topic here, but I do, before we leave it, I'm interested, though, that you... This is a big topic. It was of great importance. They're having this debate, and yet you saw it as already sort of being doomed before it began, and not to take action. And I'm just wondering what it takes, what ingredients it takes to have such a discussion that would improve the odds to your liking.
Right. So. And I'm kind of an outlier here. It's expensive to participate in these UN negotiations. You've got to fly to many distant countries. And the reason why I was kind of made a decision not to invest in this personally is because in the UN process, you have to reach consensus. So Saudi Arabia and France and the United States and Costa Rica would all have to agree on something. And I didn't think that that was going to result in anything that was actually going to solve the problem. And it's unfortunate that it's not resulting in anything. But I think, you know, we live to fight another day. And the optimist in me says that the scientific data, particularly on health, sadly gets worse and worse every year. So they should try again, and they should not have polluters at the table working to derail any significant process. And we have to try again. We can't just walk away.
Genevieve writes, single-use disposable plastic is where we need to start to change. The beneficial, quote-unquote, plastic in helmets, catheters, airbags, etc., is not what is being talked about. Convenience kills, says Genevieve. We'll take a break. We'll come back and finish up our program for this Friday morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. ORG. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Bill Hammond, Judith Eng, and Heather Mulligan with us. And we welcome your letters. Last call on the letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. As I mentioned in the introduction, that Bill is Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Bill issued an article yesterday that I thought was of importance and was picked up. And I think it's something that is worthy of our discussion. The federal government recently updated its hospital quality ratings, and New York once again fell near the bottom. Among 132 New York hospitals that received a rating, the average grade was 2.5 out of 5 stars. That is, out of 50 states, 48th. That marked a slight improvement from last year when New York ranked 49th with an average score of 2.4 stars. But I don't think even at that level you start to celebrate, right? That's still not great. The 2025 average puts New York just ahead of New Mexico and Mississippi and just behind Alabama and Arkansas and West Virginia, all of which are among the poorest states in the country. New York boasts the highest gross state product per capita in the U.S. and spends at higher than average levels on health care generally and hospital care in particular. According to the most recent national health expenditures data from 2020, New York per capita hospital expenditures were 43% higher than the national average. Looking more closely at the latest ratings, New York's share of hospitals receiving the highest rating of 5 stars at 10.1% was 1 point higher than the national average. However, the state had a relatively low number of hospitals receiving 4 stars and relatively high numbers of those just receiving 1 or 2 stars. Bill Hammond, what is happening?
I've been puzzled by this. I've been the health policy guy at the Empire Center since 2006. And my first year there, I looked at the hospital compare numbers, and we were 50th at that time. And so I wrote a blog post, and I said, the Empire Center emails our blog post to the media, and I was expecting to get phone calls. What the hell? Why are we at the bottom? It was crickets. That's the technical term for what happened. And I called a reporter and I said, don't you think this is interesting? And he goes, I just don't believe it. I think, we have good hospitals in New York.
Especially in New York City.
Yeah. Right? And so there must be something wrong with the rating system. So I said, well, if that's the case, shouldn't you do a story about that? That the federal government is wrongly accusing the New York State of having the worst hospitals in the country. It just befuddles me because this is the CMS gathered a whole bunch of experts together. They came up with what were the best metrics to follow. They crunched the numbers. They file, I think it's like 60-something different benchmarks they pay attention to. They crunched the numbers. That results in a star rating. For whatever reason, New York just consistently lands at the bottom. It's not just CMS. There's also a safety rating.
What is CMS?
Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Yeah. Go ahead.
It's a federal agency that regulates.
I know, but
I was just going to jump in, but thank you, Judith.
And there's a LeapFrog group, which is a private group that rates hospitals based on safety. they give New York consistently very low grades. And I remember once somebody interviewed them, why does New York keep ending up at the bottom? He goes, well, New York's hospitals and state officials do not seem to be focused on this issue. Mm. That's the bottom line. Mm. When I first became a reporter, we had a health commissioner named David Axelrod.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember he used to go to war with the hospitals. Mm-hmm. He would say, you know, you're charging us too much and you're not taking good care of patients. And the hospitals hated it. And, like, I mean, there was tension. Sadly, Dr. Axelrod had a health issue, made him incapacitated to be health commissioner. We have not had anyone like that since. Our health department, I think what we have is regulatory capture, where the hospitals are just such a dominant political force. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of influential board members. They're very well organized, and they're in a coalition with one of the biggest labor unions. It's just very difficult to take them on, to run up against them politically. And the result is a lot of very low-quality hospital care.
Judith made a comment a moment ago about New York City hospitals, and looking at the numbers that you report on, that New York City comes in at about 2.2, and where the Capital Region comes in at 2.6, not a great difference there. Either number is all that great.
New York City has some of the best hospitals in the world, kind of by reputation. New York Presbyterian, NYU Langone, they're
Mount Sinai.
And they actually have some of the, like, they have the cutting edge equipment, the cutting edge procedures. They have fine surgeons and specialists. They sometimes aren't great when it comes to, like, I don't want to speak about these hospitals in particular, but you can have great doctors and then you can fall down on infection control, because infection control isn't intellectually interesting. It's just washing your hands and sterilizing equipment. It's kind of the grunt work of hospital safety. What you need is pressure from consumers and from regulators to do better. You should be measuring their performance, calling them out when the performance is bad. Maybe one sign of hope that I have is that the governor has a commission on the future of healthcare, and the chair of it, a woman named Sherry Gleed, has said this is a priority for that commission. We need better hospital care. And they're going to come out with recommendations. I don't know when. The report's already overdue. If that report comes out with strong recommendations and the governor picks them up and runs with them, that will be a very good thing for the healthcare consumers of the state.
I was really interested to see that the VA hospitals outperformed the rest of the other hospitals, because that's counterintuitive. It's not what you would think, right? But I think everything that you just said, I think, is also a problem in public education. There's inconsistency, there's high variability, there's a lot of spending and not a lot of outcome, but there's no measurement between how effective are the regulations, are they serving the purpose, do we have regulations that are contrary to each other, and how responsive are the entities being regulated to the regulations. And how much are they actually striving to improve their outcomes? And I do think it's a big problem. New York spends more than any other state per capita on everything. And we do not have good outcomes. We do not score well. And I don't care what list it is. We are never first in a good way. We're first on bad lists, but we're at best, like, low middle of the pack on the list that you want to be at the top of.
One list where we were at the right end of it, and it was the vaccination rates of kindergartners.
Hmm. All right. Let's see what changes
there. We come
there.
In 22nd on access to capital, which, you know, I'm like, hey, I can celebrate 22nd. It's in the top half.
Yeah.
But we should do better.
I think Bill raises a really serious and important issue here, and I'm curious what the impact of cuts to the VA hospital system is going to mean, cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, we're going to be particularly after the midterms when a lot of these cuts happen. But, you know, the VA is decimated right now. There are numerous reports about real deficiencies among staff cuts at VA hospitals. So what's the impact of federal cuts going to be on our situation?
I guess the hospitals are always asking for money. And the state is always giving the money. There's never, like, somehow quality doesn't enter that discussion. I feel like, and that's something that Sherry Glee, the commission chair, said. We need to, she indicated that maybe we need to tie funding to quality. And that, to me, that sounds like withholding funding when the quality is poor. I don't think it's about money. If it was about money, New York would have very good hospitals, very good schools. It's about institutional behavior. It's about focus and taking things seriously. You mentioned emergency room wait times. New York has the biggest healthcare workforce in the country. It has very well-funded hospitals. Why are our emergency room wait times as bad as they are? I don't know the answer, but it seems like with the resources we have, with the existing resources we have, we should be able to do a lot better. And making it all about money and, like, constantly, you know, every year the hospitals come to Albany and they're like, this is the money that we're not getting that we need. The amount of money they're getting is going up every year. So
it sounds like the state health department needs to do a significantly better job regulating and looking at outcomes. I mean, I think in your the report that you summarized, I think what most of us are most interested in is what's the outcome.
There was, so going back to David Axelrod, one of the things he did, he zeroed in on cardiac bypass surgery, and he just measured the mortality for that procedure of every doctor at every hospital, and eventually published that publicly. And all the hospitals were like, we need to bring our numbers down just because of the public exposure.
Right to know.
He did not go in and tell them what to do. The health department didn't go in and say, you need to change your procedures in the following way. It was peer pressure. And I think the health department needs to do more of that.
We are out of time, but I thank you very much. Thanks for the great report, and thank you for explaining it. Thanks to all of you for being so wonderful, and I hope you all have a beautiful weekend. We will be back for another hour of the show, and thank you for being with us. We'll return right after this.